I want to thank you for being with us today. And once again, I want to remind you, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. Thanks for listening, gang. See you tomorrow.
This is the Quality News Network. In trading today, the Dow Jones was up more than 100 points and in record territory past the 13,200 mark. We'll have the latest numbers for you near today's close coming up in our business block. The Iraq War spending bill went back to Congress for a procedural vote to try to override the president's veto. The Democrats didn't have the two-thirds majority necessary for the override. The House vote was 222 to 203. A day after President Bush vetoed the Iraq War spending bill because it contained a timetable for U.S. troop withdrawal, he will meet with a bipartisan group of congressional leaders. Around 4,000 American troops are entering Baghdad this week as part of the U.S. troop surge. They are part of the fourth of five brigades brought in to control the sectarian violence in the Iraqi capital. Across Iraq today, at least 47 people were killed in violence. Tomorrow, a regional conference will be held in Egypt to discuss the security situation in Iraq. Turkey's prime minister asked parliament today to approve an earlier date for national elections. He asked for June 24th. The elections had been scheduled for November 4th. There are more high-level calls for Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert to resign after Monday's release of a highly critical review of how he handled the war against Hezbollah last summer. Israel's foreign minister is the latest top official to ask the prime minister to leave office. On the 10th anniversary of his election as Prime Minister, Britain's Tony Blair today announced he will be stepping down within a few weeks. Tomorrow, the Republican candidates for president in 2008 will meet at the Reagan Library in Southern California for their first presidential debate, which will air on MSNBC. Last Thursday, the Democratic candidates debated in South Carolina. Police in Los Angeles will review their use of force after violence broke out at an immigration rally yesterday. Officers used rubber bullets and batons on the demonstrators. No one was seriously injured. However, a dozen officers and about 10 protesters were hurt. The population of Los Angeles has surpassed the 4 million mark, according to the California Department of Finance. The city now has roughly the equivalent of New Zealand's entire population. California's total population is just under 38 million residents. And 4 out of 10 of the top richest counties in the U.S. are in California, according to a market research firm. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
Divorce is never a pleasant experience, but it doesn't have to be a tragedy. If you can rein in the emotions, step back from the anger and the victimhood, you can end your marriage with dignity instead of rancor. You got married with the best of intentions. Now you need to untie the marital knot with the same mutual respect. Choose collaboration instead of confrontation. Stop wasting money on lawyers. Don't drag this out for 5 years. A collaborative divorce is better for the children, family, and friends. Collaboration costs a fraction of a contended divorce and can be done within weeks rather than months or years. An award-winning documentary called Divorce Collaborative Style explains how you can end your marriage fairly and efficiently. For less than what a lawyer charges to answer one simple question, you can get all the answers from Divorce Collaborative Style. Go to collaborativedivorce.tv and order your DVD today. If it's over, end it right. CollaborativeDivorce.tv.
The Food and Drug Administration wants to expand a warning for antidepressants for young adults ages 18 to 24. The FDA says there is an increased risk of suicidal behavior during the first month of taking antidepressants. The current warning now includes only children and adolescents. Police have arrested 4 JetBlue airline employees and a New York corrections officer for shopping sprees paid by credit cards accidentally left by passengers dashing to catch their flights. Fortune magazine reports that fired radio talk show host Don Imus plans to sue to recover the $40 million CBS Radio still owes him on his contract. He was fired for racially offensive remarks he made about the women on the Rutgers basketball team. The Commerce Department reports that in March, U.S. factory orders went up by the largest amount in a year. They were up 3.1%, led by a strong demand for commercial aircraft. AAA reports since early April, gasoline prices have gone up 36%. $0.50 a gallon. The nationwide average price is just under $3 a gallon, and the group expects gas could reach an all-time high by the end of this month. Light sweet crude is trading at $63.68 a barrel, and near the close of Wall Street today, the Dow in record territory up 75 points at 13,211, the NASDAQ up 26, the S&P 500 up 10. There's more at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Allie Dramov.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Well, you've all heard about Don Imus, and a lot of us, I have to say, were surprised when he was fired. Not that he didn't deserve to be fired for what he said. After all, it wasn't even the first time Imus, or second, or third, or fourth time, he had said offensive things. But those of us who work in radio know that Imus is far from the greatest offender. A whole host of right-wing talk show hosts, from Rush Limbaugh to, Glenn Beck, a whole number of them, including such people who appear on television all the time, like Ann Coulter, say outrageous things and never seem to be punished for it. To discuss Rush Limbaugh, Don Imus, and all things you shouldn't say on radio, I've invited Steve Rendell. He's a senior analyst for the media watchdog group FAIR. FAIR stands for Fairness, Accuracy, and Reporting. And he's the author of The Way Things Aren't, Rush Limbaugh's Reign of Error. Steve Rendell, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
It's good to be on, Mark.
Let me start with Don Imus, and then I want to move on to Rush Limbaugh and others. This comment he made about the Rutgers basketball team, this wasn't his first nasty comment, was it?
No. We've been documenting his comments for about a decade. Also, along with, sometimes working with, a journalist named Philip Nobley, who has worked at several mainstream outlets and really took offense at listening to Imus. And it should be pointed out, I think Exhibit A in any case about whether or not Imus is a bigot should be from 9 years ago, when Imus was profiled on 60 Minutes by Mike Wallace. At one point during the interview, Mike Wallace said, "Well, you told my producer in the car yesterday that you hired Bernard McGuirk." That's one of his co-hosts and a producer of the show.
That's the person,
also,
in fact, who first used the word hose on air, which Imus then repeated.
Who called the Rutgers women
team
hardcore hose.
Right.
And Mike Wallace said, "You told my producer yesterday while traveling in the car off camera that you hired Bernard McGuirk to, quote, do nigger jokes," close quote.
Wow.
And as Wallace said this, Imus looked at him like he was crazy and said, "I never said any such thing." And to his credit, because this is what journalism should be about, Mike Wallace called his producer over from off camera and said, "Tom, did he say it?" And Tom came over and said, "Mr. Imus, you did say that to me." And Imus said, "Well, maybe I did, but it wasn't for the record." And to which Wallace replied, "The hell it wasn't." And so what you found...
Wow. I'd like to see that 60 Minutes episode.
They replayed it. Mark, they re-aired it about a week and a half ago.
I'm sorry, I missed that one.
I'm wondering if it was after it was all over. We were trying to get him to re-air it when it first started. Now, the point is here, from FAIR's point of view, we're a free speech group. We are for confronting irresponsible or racist or bigoted speech with more enlightened speech. We don't call for people to be fired. We did not call for CBS or NBC. Those were Imus's two employers. NBC is the owner of MSNBC, and CBS owned both Westwood One, which was Imus's syndicator, and WFAN, the sports talk station in New York City that was Imus's home station. We didn't call for them to fire Imus. What we do is we publish what is said, and we comment on it. We call it what it is. It's bigotry and racism. Also, along the line, I mean, there have been many other incidents where Imus and his associates on the show, his sort of morning zoo colleagues, have been caught out in racist and other sorts of bigoted statements.
Steve, let me ask you this, because I'd never really listened to Don Imus, frankly. I listened to him more since this happened than before, but I know he has a wide listenership. You mentioned that he's done this for a decade. How long has he been on air, and has he always been this incendiary, or is this a question of his bosses, Westwood One, MSNBC, and others, encouraging him to be incendiary?
Well, I know that Imus's radio career goes back, I think, more than 30 years. I think it may go back, it may even go back into the late 60s, which would make it almost 40 years. I know that he didn't start out there. I think he started out as a music DJ, and I think he was actually something of a liberal at one point. Right now, even today, he's not particularly conservative.
Right, which is one reason why I wonder why that may have led to his firing.
Yeah,
because
he's sort of a faddist is what he is.
Right.
I mean, I believe that he was for Bush in 2000, and then by 2004, or he hated Bush and was against him and endorsed Kerry. He's not a guy of any kind of sort of, doesn't have a solid foundation in politics. But anyway, the point is here that we were not calling for him to be fired. We were just asking CBS and NBC to say, what are your standards and practices? Anybody who works in radio or television knows that stations and networks have standards and practices. There's certain things that you can't say on the air, and they tell you what those are. And we asked NBC and CBS to tell us what those were. We failed in getting them to divulge that. But that gets to your last question, that is whether or not they were encouraging him.
I'm trying to figure out, Steve. I mean, is this a guy
who... They were encouraging him.
He's always been a racist and he slipped, or is this a guy who is intentionally using this kind of language because he thinks it increases his rating?
Well, you know, in 2004, when his sidekick Sid Rosenberg referred to Palestinians generally as filthy animals, MSNBC actually came out and gave an apology. There have been other times along the way where he's been caught, he or one of his colleagues on the Imus in the Morning show have been caught in bigotry and have had to either make apologies, and in several cases people have been fired. For instance, Sid Rosenberg was fired one time for bigotry on the show, only to be brought back later. The apologies, the conciliation only serves to sort of take the heat, the pressure off of Imus until the next time. So they know full well that they're making money at CBS and NBC off of bigotry. They knew this. They would put him through these sort of obligatory reprimands, and he'd stay on the air, and he'd keep making money for them. So I know that his record of bigotry goes back at least until the mid-90s. I can't say before that. I know he was a contemporary, even at the same station here in New York City, WNBC, as Howard Stern, and they were both known as shock jocks. I am not as familiar with his work then.
Okay, my question when we come back from break is going to be, why now? Here he has said these things, and if you look at a list, and if you don't mind giving us, I know that it's shocking stuff, but, well, it's been said on radio, and of course we're not saying it the way he does, meant to hurt, but he said a whole list of things about blacks, women, Jews, Palestinians, really almost everyone. Why are we suddenly more sensitive now? Is that a good thing? And what does it mean for the likes of Rush Limbaugh and Coulter and all of them? The toll-free number, if you want to call in, is 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366, and give your point of view. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise. prize.
Head on radionetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at headonradionetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
Must have been prayer meeting with Reverend Brother Bob.
See, hey, Peter, welcome to the program.
You absolutely know that you cannot mention Robert Sunday without conjuring me. This is the known fact.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Right. Well, sometimes I do it on purpose.
You know, the thing that kills me, you know, God just continues to punk Robertson. After time, after time, and it goes back for years. You know, let's talk a minute about his business venture. From 91 to 94, he was involved in something called Calo Vita, and it was a multi-level marketing company that breathed that pyramid scheme.
Yeah, like Amway.
Sold beauty products and healthcare products. Oh, they had a product called Sea of Galilee Mud Mask.
No, they did not.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
You no.
Bob, as a heart attack, I'm serious.
Sea of Galilee Mud Mask?
Oh, yes. It was part of the product line.
Prayer meeting edition of Head On with Bob Kincaid, Wednesday nights, 6 to 9 p.m. here on the Head On Radio Network.
What would happen if you didn't follow the established path? If you did the unexpected? Would you feel scared? Proud? Relieved? Could you explain that helping the people of Peru improve their own community would also have an effect on your own? Or assisting an entrepreneur in Ukraine to launch her small business? Or creating a support group in Malawi for children orphaned by AIDS? What if you established your own path? One that others might follow? Would you rather make your own way? Or spend your life saying, what if? Life is calling. How far will you go? Peace Corps. To find out more, call 1-800-424-8580. Or go to peacecorps.gov.
You're listening to the Head On Radio Network.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're discussing not just Don Imus' firing, but also how does that relate to all those other right-wing jerks on the radio and the hate speech that they give there. I'm talking with Steve Rendell. He is the senior analyst at the media watchdog group FAIR. He's also the author of the book, The Way Things Aren't, Rush Limbaugh's Reign of Error. Steve Rendell, welcome back to the Inside Scoop.
It's good to be here.
Before the break, I was trying to figure out what makes 2000 difference. I mean, Don Imus has said, you know more than I do, more than a dozen of these comments over the past 10 years?
Oh, no. Thousands. Just to give you and Don Imus, to be clear, to be accurate, Don Imus with his sidekicks, Bernard McGurk, Sid Rosenberg, there's another guy named McCord that's often on the show.
And they usually do the more offensive stuff than he does.
Well, let me just give a quick roundup, and that is, Imus himself called Gwen Ifill, who a lot of your listeners will be familiar with. She's one of the anchors on the NewsHour.
Sure,
Jim
Lehrer. Yeah. Right.
He called her when she was working at the New York Times the cleaning lady. He called the sports reporter at the New York Times, Bill Roden, who's also African American, a quota hire. He's referred to the Knicks as chest thumping pimps, and to the New York Knicks basketball. The Knicks or the New York Knicks basketball team. He called those chest-thumping pimps. He called their longtime center, Patrick Ewing, a gorilla. He referred to his own colleague, John Hockenberry, the reporter that many of your listeners will be familiar with, an NBC reporter
sure.
who is wheelchair-bound
right.
as the cripple, more than once, many times.
Is this just what he thinks, or is this, again, because CBS says if you say these things, your ratings will go up.
Well, the way that they're used is in a derisive way. It's in a hateful way. Whether or not it's in his mind, I don't really care. This is going out over the airwaves. It's not done in. You were mentioning the difference between the way we're using it when I describe
right.
Imus on the CBS 60 Minutes show saying that he hired somebody to quote do nigger jokes close quote. We're trying to educate people
right.
about something. We're not using that in order to harm. Now, as in the context that he uses these terms, they're meant to put down. It's hard to draw, it's my opinion, that it's very hard to be an equal opportunity bigot or an equal opportunity smearer, as Imus and many other broadcasting bigots say they are, because frankly, there isn't language that has the same context. I'm a white guy. I'm a white guy who's part of a privileged class in the United States. If you call me a honky or a cracker, that doesn't mean anything to me. It doesn't hurt my feelings. Those words were never part of a system that was meant to oppress or keep me down. So when people say, oh, he also would talk about people being crackers or honkies, well, you know, yeah, he probably shouldn't have done that either, and I'm not going to dismiss that out of hand. But the fact is, those are not as powerful a terms as using terms like the N-word.
Steve, what is it about 2007 that after thousands of comments by Don Imus that at best would get an apology, CBS suspended him, and then, to all of our surprise, certainly to my surprise, it was just going to be a two-week suspension, a slap on the wrist. They actually fired him, so much so that he's actually suing now for $40 million, apparently, because he's been fired. What's the change? Is it Michael Richards? Is it Mel Gibson? Tim Hardaway? Are these kinds of things in the public eye? Is that the change?
I don't think there is a change. I'll tell you, it is the conventional media wisdom, Mark, that you're repeating here, that somehow people, that we've become more sensitive this year, that this stuff would not have been as noticed 5 years ago or 10 years ago. I don't think that's true. I think what happened for Imus was sort of his perfect storm. He had, as we pointed out, been caught at this, and there had been minor reprimands and even some firings, almost always temporary firings, where he invited the people like Sid Rosenberg back to the show after a decent interval. But I don't think things have changed. I think what happened in this case, Imus said something. Imus called an accomplished, sympathetic group of young athletes at Rutgers, who had made it to the finals of the NCAA women's basketball tournament, he called them nappy-headed hoes. He picked on somebody. He picked on a target that was prominent in the news, at least for a few days, at the time that they were enjoying their moment in the sun. And I think there was just sort of a universal revulsion. I won't say completely universal, but I think most people just went like, he said what? You know, just looking and thinking, why would this come over this guy, you know?
Yeah, that's a really interesting analysis because, of course, just last week, Rush Limbaugh went on his show with a song sung to Puff the Magic Dragon called Barack the Magic Negro, which he blamed on an article by David Ehrenstein in the L.A. Times. But, of course, he took David Ehrenstein's argument and turned it into a mocking racist ditty. But because Obama is a powerful man, he's a senator, he's running for president, people feel like he can take care of himself. Is that the reason why virtually no one heard about Rush's comments, whereas everyone heard about Imus?
Well, you know, Limbaugh has a long history. I actually wrote a piece for the Los Angeles Times when ABC was considering hiring Limbaugh as the color man on Monday Night Football. This is 7 or 8 years ago, and I wrote a piece.
Well, wasn't
he
hired
time.
For like a week or two until he?
No, he was never hired for that.
Quarterback.
He was never hired for that. In fact, I think that go around they ended up hiring Dennis Miller.
Oh, great.
But Limbaugh lasted for months on ESPN until he made the comment about Donovan McNabb, the Eagles quarterback. But I think Well, Limbaugh's very smart. The comment that he made about, and you're exactly right, Mark, that Magic Negro theme originated in the Los Angeles Times column.
It was an op-ed,
wasn't
even the LA Times.
An op-ed that was explaining something that happens in movies. And it was actually, the writer was talking about Obama, but it wasn't meant derisively. It was what
I read
is,
the
it
article.
About,
it was an attack on white people, is what it was.
That's right. It
rather than
about,
Obama.
The term actually did not originate in that column. The term originated years ago, as I recall, in film critique about how sometimes black people, if you think of The Green Mile, they show up, they're mysterious, they have spiritual qualities, and they end up helping white people and generally dying. And it's a
movie
name
theme
to give to a certain kind of theme, a certain kind of character that just seems to spring up in American movies and help black people who help white people. And this writer in the LA Times was trying to make the point that a lot of white people, and I could go on about this, but this
yeah,
is...
Yeah, no, I read the article, and
right,
I actually...
and that a lot of white people are putting all their hopes, and they see Obama as this sympathetic person, and if he could only get in, and that would, boy, that would cleanse our nation of racism and that thing, and therefore he could be the magic Negro. Now, Rush realized that the term had been originally used by this liberal writer in the L.A. Times.
Who's African-American,
so,
as it happens.
Right, and he saw... He also saw it as being sort of an inoculation for himself. Well, this other guy called him that, so I can.
Exactly. So, what's interesting about Rush, and actually very clever of him, is that, of course, he sang his song without any context whatsoever.
That's right.
But he used it, he footnoted something with context as his out so that no one could complain. But basically, he used it as a license to do his own racist ditty that not only attacked
exactly.
Obama, but Al Sharpton, and had Al Sharpton use double negatives and bad English and all kinds of other very racist things. But I didn't hear, I assume your organization was on it. I haven't heard much critique about that.
Well, I think, if we had a healthy media culture, if we had hard-hitting journalists that weren't afraid of powerful people, that did the job, one of the most important tasks of journalism is to go to those in power and hold their feet to the fire. And Limbaugh has quite a bit of power. He's on more than 650 radio stations across the country, claims to have, I don't think he actually does, something in the neighborhood of 20 million listeners. And... So he
but
has
didn't
power.
I miss
a
off
tough
power
journalist,
too?
A tough journalist would have said, look what he did. He took this subtle thesis from the L.A. Times and decided to use it. He referenced it, exactly what you just explained. He referenced it so that he could cover himself, inoculate himself against charges of racism. But how did he use it on the air? How did the listener hear it? The listener heard sort of a... it was a sort of a blackface parody.
That's exactly what it was. It was a minstrel show. And the other thing I felt about that song... was he was actually warning white people, saying, in effect, that if you vote for a black man, any black man, then you're a racist because you're doing it only out of white guilt. You could never vote for Obama because you think he's an inspiring person or he's got new ideas. You only are voting for him out of white guilt. Rethink your votes. It was a very powerful message that he made fun of Obama. He made fun of Sharpton. He did his racist ditty. He blamed someone else. And at the same time, he took away from Obama's support because he made white people, some at least, say, oh, really, am I voting for him out of guilt? It's this very powerful thing, and yet no one calls him on it.
And I think it's because of his power and because journalists are lazy, too. That's not the easiest thing to report, to explain how he took this sort of legitimate, subtle argument and turned it into basically a blackface.
Okay, but Imus had a lot of power, too. I mean, he not only had, probably at least half as many listeners as Rush Limbaugh would think, plus he was on MSNBC every morning. He'd been in radio longer than Rush Limbaugh. How is it that the media and the public could take Imus down and not Limbaugh? And does it have to do with the fact that Imus is kind of in the middle politically, isn't much of a political actor, and Rush Limbaugh is a hero of the far right?
Well, I think as far as gutter-level bigotry, I would actually say that Imus' show is worse than Limbaugh's. Does not – I can show you, I've documented in my book and other times, back in the 70s, Limbaugh once told a black caller, call me back when you get the bone out of your nose. He another time said around 1990 – he said, ever notice how all composite pictures of wanted criminals resemble Jesse Jackson? Pretty much saying that all criminals are
right,
black.
Right, all are black.
Yeah. And,
so has he
many
so
more
toned
of those,
it down since
but
then.
He did. He doesn't use that stuff on a daily basis. It was practically daily on Imus. The wonder about Imus is how he lasted so long, and the answer to that is that because he had, if you remember the old movie A Gentleman's Agreement, which was about... anti-Semitism in the United States. He had a rumble line, a long line of prominent journalists appearing on his show
right.
who exchanged their silence for the opportunity to be on the show, appear folksy and human. People like Tim Russert, Jonathan Alter, goes on and on, Tom Oliphant, liberals even, who'd go on the show and say nothing about the bigotry that would go on in the show. And how do we know they knew about it? Because it's true that often these journalists who were coming on to talk about politics would not hear the worst of the bigotry. We know that they knew it because we sent them tapes. We sent them letters. Phil Nobley, the journalist I was talking about earlier, did the same thing. Phil Nobley had several spirited conversations with people like Tim Russert and Jonathan Alter from Newsweek, of course, Tim Russert from NBC and Meet the Press, and asked them, why do you continue to go on this show? And the only journalist who Phil Nobley was able to get through to, where he got four journalists, all of them black, to agree to no longer go on the show. One of them, Clarence Page, the Chicago Tribune columnist based in Washington, D.C., went on the show and made Imus read a pledge to forswear racism and bigotry.
Interesting.
That didn't mean anything because that was 6 or 7 years ago. And
so in other words, these journalists did a lot of what Judith Miller did on to the administration. In other words, she wanted access, so she was willing to compromise her reporting. We've got to take another break, folks. If you want to join in the discussion, it's easy to do. Pick up the phone and dial 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to the Head On Radio Network.
There's one place on the web you can go that's so topical you can apply it liberally. WD40.com. WDYAD40.com. Claude, Wally, and Dookie are there. They're working hard every day to give you updates in news, politics, and a great sense of humor. So stop on by and see the boys at WD40.com, a place where you can raise your voice and be heard. WD40.com, your one-stop shop for all things progressive.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. The Democrats must stand strong against the current of compromise that's swirling around the funding of the Iraq War. After Bush's veto, there's been lots of talk already in Washington about crafting an acceptable bill. But no bill is acceptable that continues funding for this war and this occupation. Yet the Democrats seem to be seriously contemplating a compromise on an already compromised bill. Now, rather than insist on a deadline for withdrawal that was fudgeable in the first place, they appear to be ready to settle for no deadline at all, just some unenforceable benchmarks for the Maliki government. Last week, in the context of Iraq, Harry Reid tipped his hand, saying, "I'm a legislator, and I believe legislating is the art of compromise." There may be times to compromise, but this isn't one of them. The Democrats, brought to power on the crest of anti-war sentiment, need to honor the wishes of the American people. They need to find the courage to withstand the slurs from Bush and Cheney and their parrots on Fox News and right-wing radio. They need to defund the war. That's their constitutional duty, not compromise. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
The difference between what I do on my show and what all the right-wing types do on their shows is very simple. I'm not going to lie to you. That doesn't mean you're going to agree with me about everything or that you're going to like hearing everything I have to say, but I will guarantee you that when I say something on my show, I say it because I mean it and I believe it, and I'm not just saying it to get you riled up and to boost my ratings. No potty mouth, no trash talking, no BS, just the straight truth as I see it, because the lies may sound good for a while, but the truth is there forever. It's not always pleasant, it's not always nice, sometimes it's hard to see through all the crap, but it's there. And that's what you're going to get from me, and that's why you should listen to my show. The Cup of Joe Radio Show, Mondays and Fridays from noon to 2 Eastern Standard Time on the Head On Radio Network.
This is The Horn, the Head On Radio Network.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're having a very interesting conversation with our guest, Steve Rendell. He's the author of The Way Things Aren't, Rush Limbaugh's Reign of Error. And we're talking about, well, not just right-wing radio, but hate speech on radio. And it's interesting to make that distinction. Steve, in progressive radio, a lot of times we will talk about right-wing radio in the way that it has such an advantage, if you will, over our genre. But what is the difference between right-wing radio and hate radio? And how are they? How does the rise of right-wing radio help hate speech in radio?
Well, actually, you've touched on something that's one of my favorite subjects, and that's history of media. And if you look at right-wing talk radio, people on the left and the right get this wrong. They often say, the right says, oh, right-wing talk radio really was born after the Fairness Doctrine was struck down in 1988, 1987. And the left says basically the same thing. They say, oh, yes, when the Fairness Doctrine was struck down, then it went all right all the time. When, in fact, right-wing talk radio has always had the advantage. Talk radio really started as a genre, as a money-making genre, in about 1960. And some of its earliest stars, people like Joe Pine and I can't remember his first name, but his name is Farber from here in New York. Right-wing hosts were the rule. Liberal hosts were the exception. That made sense. Right-wing talk radio started in the shadow of McCarthyism. In fact, John Henry Falk would not strike down the blacklist until 1962.
Well, Father Coughlin was known in the 1930s for doing
that
racist,
wasn't talk. Yeah,
radio.
I'm making a distinction. That wasn't talk radio, but that's exactly right, and it's a good point to make. People like Gerald L.K. Smith, Father Coughlin, far-right broadcasters were acceptable in many cases because they were considered corporate-friendly. Now, Coughlin is a little more complicated because
Coughlin was pro-Nazi.
He was pro-Nazi at one point. He was a socialist when he started in the 20s. That was before there was a lot of corporate influence, as much corporate influence as there would be by the late 30s. And he was eventually forced from the air because the United States was gearing up for war. But with the Nazis. But yes, it's true. We've always had, our radio culture has always had this much bigger appetite for right-wing opinion than for left-wing opinion.
Do you think that's natural? Do you think that right-wingers listen to angry talk radio more than the people on the left do? Or is it just an evolutionary coincidence, the right guy first?
The first answer to that question, is it natural, is that when you're talking about corporate-owned, corporate advertiser-driven media, yes, corporate-friendly broadcasters, the right is generally perceived by business as being more corporate-friendly than the left, and I think that's probably a fair perception, as in 2004, Sumner Redstone, the CEO of Viacom, the owner of CBS and many other media properties, did an interview, and he was quite candid, and he actually said what FAIR has been saying since we were founded 20 years ago. He said, well, first he started out by saying what a great guy John Kerry was. He's a great guy, an honorable man, really a fine man. But the Republicans are far better for our business, and therefore I am endorsing George Bush. It's a matter of corporate friendliness.
Let me make a distinction
first,
if I can. Okay, I mean, there's the right-left debates, and then there's hate speech. I mean, I invite Republicans on my show all the time. I disagree with them. But at least the ones I invite on my show don't engage in racism, anti-Semitism, you know, the kind of anti-Semitism that goes beyond criticizing a Supreme Court decision and actually attacking people personally. I mean, even people who are very friendly to corporations, and I admit I'm not one of them, don't have to be so hateful. What is the connection, if any, is it just that the same people who are right-wing tend to be bigots? Or is there a way that the, you know, CBS and others who control the industry want this kind of hate language because it gives better ratings?
I don't think it's that they necessarily want it. They do what has ratings. They do have there are certain oxes they won't gore. We have double standards in our society and in our media about racism and bigotry. There are certain things we are very sensitive to, and rightfully. Anti-Semitism, for one. I'm not saying there's no anti-Semitism left in the country, but if someone were to go on, if Imus had gone on his radio show and talked about these quote-unquote kikes over here or there 10 years ago, I'm guessing he wouldn't have lasted.
But
to
he
make
did
comment
make comments about Jews, as I
yeah,
recall.
He did.
Something
he
about
called,
Jewish money, something.
Yes, he called Howard Kurtz, the Washington Post media reporter, a beanie-wearing Jew boy.
That's not exactly kind.
No. That's anti-Semitism. But
I mean, the word kike is actually kind of archaic. It's not even used by anti-Semites anymore.
He also said about Simon & Schuster, the publishers, he said, he called them thieving Jews, and then he came on with a mock apology later and said that he apologized because that was redundant. Those things were basically taken from some of the people that came on the shows, many of them Jews, people like Howard Feynman and Howard Kurtz, who continued to come on the show and said, oh, no, he didn't mean anything by that. It was part of the gentleman's agreement. The people who should have been offended by it and should have said something were giving him a free pass. I probably should have used a different example because I think he got away with it because he was so close to these journalists, some of the most powerful journalists in the country. If another radio host, if Glenn Beck, say, or even Limbaugh, started going off on, you know, using some nasty term for Jews, I think you'd have a discussion, and we should. And this is how it should be. That's the standard we should have for everyone, or
well, let me
perhaps
ask you,
even a higher one for that.
In your book, and you say the way things are, and I mean, the stuff that you mentioned that Limbaugh said about blacks is obviously extremely offensive, and frankly, in my ears, it's far worse than what I missed recently said about the Rutgers team. I mean, the bone in your nose stuff, that's way out there. I think the time at least was different 10 years ago when he said that. Is he on a leash now? Are people watching him really carefully, or does Rush Limbaugh have simply more power than Imus and therefore can withstand doing the kind of thing that Imus has done?
Well, the bone in your nose quote, to be fair, was 30 years ago.
It was in the 70s,
and he was known as a DJ named Jeff Christie at the time.
Okay.
Rush was practically a different career. I'm not sure we should be holding people responsible for things
that long.
He did make the comment about Jesse Jackson in 1990, which is a little bit more modern.
Well, it's interesting because Ann Coulter, who in many ways I consider a performance artist because she is someone who makes her extreme comments, that's the only reason she exists,
is by
virtue of her extreme comments. As far as I can see, she has no other talents except for throwing firebombs. When she made her very strange comment calling this presidential candidate John Edwards a faggot, which makes no sense in any – it doesn't even make sense. I mean, he's not gay. But it seems like people are backing away from her now. Do you see that in the industry, or is this some temporary thing, and then she'll be right back throwing firebombs on Fox News?
I'm not sure they're backing away. I mean, I remember a while ago where she made some nasty thing about Islam and about Arabs.
Right, she said convert them all, kill their leaders and convert them all, or something to that effect.
Right, and Rich Lowry, the editor of the National Review, and Jonah Goldberg, who was, an editor at National Review Online, they got in a tiff with her because they were publishing her, and they fired her column from their magazine, and they've distanced themselves, but that's also a personal thing. She still shows up on Fox News all the time. I'm not sure I saw her just 3 days ago, well after the comment about John Edwards.
One of my listeners pointed out a few weeks ago that Bernard McGuirk, who actually, if you read the transcript or listen to the whole shtick, if you will, between him and Don Imus about the Rutgers team, McGuirk actually is worse than Imus. As bad as Imus is, McGuirk is sort of feeding him the lines. He's the one that says hardcore hoes, and then
Imus owns the show, though, and that's all. I understand, and he's responsible. That's the same way that I hold that ultimately the most responsible are the broadcasters, the ones that hold the license or run the station.
Well, my point was that McGuirk appeared on Fox News.
Yeah.
With a wink and a nod by Sean Hannity, I look forward to having you back on the radio.
Yes, and he called Al Sharpton a terrorist in that appearance. I watched that. Yes, that was feeling sorry for himself and talking about
Sean Hannity get punished? That's my question.
Well, Hannity is very strange. I've known Hannity since he first started in New York. He's actually from Long Island, but he had a stint where he ran a very homophobic radio show out in Santa Barbara, California, where he'd put people on it was really one of the most disgusting things you can imagine about gay people. You can read that piece that I wrote about that on FAIR's website at FAIR.org. But when he first came to New York, he was his huge hero was Bob. The guy.
he was the biggest talk show host in New York City. He was on WABC, and this was Hannity's hero. And FAIR publicized this guy's remarks. Bob Grant. Bob Grant called black people savages all the time. We published his remarks until we were blue in the face. We finally got the governor of New Jersey at the time, Christine Todd Whitman, to meet with a group of rabbis and black clergy and listen to a tape of Grant. And she agreed that she would no longer go on his show except to go on to challenge his racism. And she kept her word. She went on his show and she challenged
so,
him over racism.
Is the answer that Hannity and Limbaugh and all of them...
Hannity saw that, and he took notice, and he has sort of reverted to, I think, as, yes, I've taken a long time to answer your question. As Limbaugh has, what they've done is they've sort of reverted back to just all code word racism all the time. That is, they talk about illegitimacy, crime, welfare, affirmative action, all these terms that are, in their hands, are all arguments against
Yes, they don't use the N word. They just talk bad about black people all
the time. Yeah, it's code word. It's code word racism. But they don't. And I have never actually, I have watched Hannity fairly closely. Hannity used to call me up. He was so worried that we were going to call him a racist. He used to call me up and say, I heard somebody told me you're doing a study on me. I'd say, no, Sean, we're still not doing a study on you. You're not important enough. But he certainly has risen through the ranks. He's a fairly important broadcaster today and very valuable to the Republican Party.
Steve, we have to take another break. But when we come back, I want to ask you how essential hate speech is to right-wing radio. I kind of want to get a real strong answer to that question because I don't know, is it required? Is that part of the rights agenda, or can you separate it for the rights agenda? And I also want to ask you about FAIR.org. You've been around FAIR for about 20 years, how you started and what your concentration is. Folks, if you want to call in, there's one last chance to do it. I know Steve's so interesting, it's hard to get a word in edgewise, but the toll-free number is 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
Harry Potter has given us all a unique glimpse at education the way it ought to be. Never once do Harry and his Hogwarts friends talk about skipping class, ducking tough instructors, waiving requirements, or shirking responsibilities. That perspective, be practical, get it the easiest, fastest, cheapest way you can, is what J.K. Rowling terms the Muggle approach to education. We're Concord University, and do we have a deal for you? At Concord, education's different than anywhere else around. There's a reason that Concord students get the best jobs, are sought out by the best medical, graduate, and law schools in the land. It's no wonder that Concord has been cited by U.S. News & World Report and by the Wall Street Journal. Where do I sign up? At Southern West Virginia's version of Track 9 3/4. All you have to do is believe, and believe in yourself. Concord University, an education you can put to work. 1-888-384-5249.
Obviously need to address the issue of the Saddam Hussein execution. Have seen the video that was taken on the cell phone, or have read about the circumstances surrounding the execution. It's pretty evident that the absolutely worst thing that could have happened with the carrying out of the sentence after the long trial of Saddam Hussein happened. And if we had sat down and made a list and said, all right, here's a list of 6 or 7 different things that could happen, what would be the very, very worst thing that could happen, not only for us, for the United States, but for the world and for the Iraqis themselves? And it seems to me that if not first, then definitely second would have been what indeed did happen.
The Dr. Bill O'Brien Show, Tuesday to Thursday, noon to 2 Eastern, here on the Head On Radio Network.
Listen, man, adding fractions is no big deal.
No,
you just gotta find what they call the common denominator. Let me show you.
All right.
Now, see these bottom numbers?
Yeah.
These are the denominators. That one's a 4 and that one's an 8.
Mm-hmm.
You just double both of these numbers so that becomes an 8 too. Then you add them up.
Man, you sure make this easy.
Charles Bennett always dreamed that after college he'd return to the old neighborhood as a teacher.
but without the money for tuition, only half of his dream came true. He's back in the old neighborhood.
Well, enough math. I gotta deliver these sandwiches.
Oh, sure.
Please support the United Negro College Fund. Call 1-800-332-UNCF. A mind is a terrible thing to waste. A public service brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
This is the Horn, the Head-On Radio Network.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Just a few minutes left with my guest, Steve Rendell. He is a senior analyst for the media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. It's called FAIR. You can find it at fair.org. There's a link from my website at radioinsidescoop.com. He's also the author of The Way Things Aren't, Rush Limbaugh's Reign of Error. Steve, I wanted to ask you if there are any prominent right-wing talk show hosts that don't have this racist past. I mean, can you separate it from, it seems to me you can be a corporatist and you can be supportive of George Bush without being a racist. Are any prominent radio hosts there, or do they all seem to have this racist background?
I think of the top ones in the country, I think you find, at the very least, on their shows, regular code word racism. That is, the focus on crime, illegitimacy, the terms I mentioned before.
By
the top ones. I've done thousands of radio shows over the years. I did probably 300 or 400 radio shows just behind the publication of the Rush Limbaugh book. Most of those were right-wing, and I have to say that probably more than half of those were very civilized shows. These are right-wing radio shows, people that I don't agree with, very civilized, let me have my say. We had informative conversation, debate, disagreed on things. So I don't think it's absolutely necessary. What I will say is, let me point again to Bob Grant. Bob Grant was the most successful radio talk show host in the country 10 years ago. He had 1 million listeners in New York alone. He followed Limbaugh on WABC. That's Limbaugh's home station here in New York. Limbaugh, by comparison, had 300,000 listeners in New York. Limbaugh used code word racism. Bob Grant used the real thing. He was a bigot in many ways. As I said, he called black people savages. He once called on the NYPD to take machine guns to a gay parade and, quote, mow them down, close quote.
What decade are we talking about with
90s.
Bob Grant?
The 90s.
Okay, yeah. So this isn't the 60s and the 70s.
No. This was in the 90s, and he was fired because we didn't call for it. But, again, we kept publishing the things he said, and we kept getting journalists to publish them. And he was fired when Disney bought ABC, and Disney was a far more sensitive, with their sort of family-friendly image. They were far more sensitive than Cap Cities, the previous owner of ABC's, what ABC was. So it
does. So corporate ownership really does matter.
I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's necessary to be a bigot to succeed. But I can't help but looking at the experience of these shows and think it helps. There was something about Grant that resonated with a lot of people here in the New York area. And this area has a reputation of being liberal, right?
Liberal and diverse,
but
and
I think
people of different cultures.
I don't think you can put it
together.
All. But, Mark, I don't think you can put it all. I think the fact that 1 million people wanted to hear that tells us that the problem is deeper than just a handful of talk show hosts. Our media reflect our society. And the racism that erupts in the media here and there is reflective of a deeper racism in our society, and it really even more underlines why we need to talk more in journalism, in the media. We need to discuss racism, discuss where it comes from, and more frankly, and it really is almost a taboo subject, except for every now and then when, Michael Richards had his little explosion on a comedy stage in California, where we wouldn't even have known about it if it wasn't for somebody with a cell phone video.
Let me ask you about racism, though, among minorities themselves, because when I listen, certainly rap music is, I think, fairly criticized for coarsening our language, for encouraging not just blacks, but frankly more often white teenagers to use ghetto language, the N-word or hoes and so forth. And I just watched the other day Mind of Mencia, which, but I don't know, it was before or after The Daily Show, which I like to watch. And I guess was surprised at really the crude racist imagery that Carlos Mencia gets away with, I guess because he's Latino, and like he says, he attacks everyone. But it's interesting to me, obviously this is far broader than just right-wing talk show hosts.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is an emerging thing with Sarah Silverman the same way. There's
right,
a lot of
her too.
There's a lot of comics who claim to be sort of like meta bigots. They're
right.
They use bigotry and they say they're going beyond it. I don't buy it. I'm with you. I think Mind of Mencia and Silverman say things that shouldn't be said. Say things that we should at least discuss exactly. You know, question them. Why? Why is that okay for you but not for others? Because I think they would probably argue that there still is racism. It's just not what they're doing.
I also think there's a difference between when you attack your own people, if as it were, and when you attack others. I mean, I kind of give myself license to tell Jewish jokes, and I do, although mine are not, you know, I certainly don't tell Holocaust jokes and other extremely offensive things, but, you know, things that gently mock traits of self-perceived traits of my people, I think are okay, just as I hear black comments talk about black society in a, you know, in a loving, if funny way. What I find that Mencia does, and Sarah Silverman too, though, although I haven't seen as much of her, is not this sort of gentle mocking that everyone talks about their own culture, but really crude, racist, almost Amos and Andy-like portrayal.
Yeah, the show Colin Quinn had on Comedy Central had a number of people doing the same things on it, too, of various ethnicities, the same things that Mencia and Silverman are doing. You know, one of the things that, Mark, when I did a lot of shows about Imus, particularly about 3 weeks ago, I did tons of shows, and you would get callers calling in all the time and saying, yeah, what about rap music? Well, the first point that I would make is that nobody's giving 50 Cent or Ludacris national television and radio shows to spout their stuff. But that's elsewise, I think the comparison is fair enough. It's in many cases the same corporations that owned Imus's show that own the rap record industry. And it should be pointed out that some of the biggest stars, some of the most saleable ones, a lot of critics think the least talented, are the ones who use the bitches and hoes as punctuation in their songs. They are, again, we're looking at corporations who are interested not in edifying or educating people, but in making profit. And they don't care if it's off bigotry. They'll make profit any way they can. It's not that they're trying to promote bigotry per se, but they certainly are not averse from profiting from it.
I wonder, Steve, if to some extent we're fighting a losing battle, though. I mean, you mentioned that Grant had a million listeners in the 1990s. Certainly Rush Limbaugh is extremely popular. Frankly, as George Bush gets more unpopular, it seems to me that Limbaugh's praise of him isn't carrying as much weight as his old racist ditties, that he's sort of resorting back to where the right really stands, if you will. Some don't like the war in Iraq, but they sure like attacking black people. But there are so many people out there that like this humor. We do support free speech. How do you, if you will, tell people this is wrong without encouraging people to think like, you know, those that do drugs because it's illegal? Hey, this is cool. The mainstream says this is wrong, therefore it's really cool to listen to it. How do you fight that?
Well, I think the fact that those people are popular and particularly the ones that are more bigoted seem to be rise to the top of the heap, I think it reflects that we have a society that has a problem with bigotry and discrimination and racism and such. I think the thing we need to do, and I think this is where journalism is failing, often talk radio, I'm sure to Comedy Central to some degree too, is sort of considered some of the fever swamps of media, and it's not covered very much. You don't get much coverage of talk radio until you have these huge eruptions like the Imus affair. I think what journalism should do, and we're media critics here, we don't mainly talk about radio here, we mainly talk about journalism, and that is we need to discuss race and racism and bigotry, homophobia, anti-Semitism, all of these things a lot more and get to the bottom of them. When we discuss these things, I think people see commonalities. I think they can be dealt with. They can't be dealt with if the only time we talk about them is in orgies of finger-pointing after the next Imus or the next Michael Richard goes off.
Steve, it's a fair point. Just before we wrap up, we only got about a minute left. tell me what listeners can find if they buy your book, The Way Things Aren't, Rush Limbaugh's Reign of Error.
Well, the book is getting a little dated at this point,
okay.
But it makes an absolute ironclad case that Rush Limbaugh mainly just doesn't tell the truth. It has him saying things like, folks, the New York Times never did a story on Whitewater, when, in fact, as anyone in journalism knows, Jeff Girth, the New York Times investigative reporter, broke the Whitewater story. When Limbaugh made that remark, the Times had done 80 stories on
Whitewater. So it's a whole list of
absolutely slam-dunk falsehoods and, in some cases, lies. We know they're lies because we informed him of the truth of these issues, and he went out and repeated the things. Before
well,
that,
friend,
we called
that's
him
that's
false.
That's a great gift. All of us have a strange friend or family member or distant cousin who actually praises Rush Limbaugh. We all know. We all have them. It's not your fault. I have one in my family, too. This sounds like a great gift for that kind of person so that they can realize and maybe come out of their shell a bit. Dee Rendell, thank you so much. An hour went by very quickly. Thanks for coming here on The Inside Scoop.
Thanks.
Tune in tomorrow. We're going to talk about the presidential veto of the Democratic plan to withdraw the troops. For now, this is Mark Levine signing off.
You're listening to the Head On Radio Network.
This is the Quality News Network. In trading today, the Dow Jones was up more than 100 points and in record territory past the 13,200 mark. We'll have the closing numbers for you coming up in our business blog. A day after President Bush vetoed the Iraq War spending bill because it contained a timetable for U.S. troop withdrawal, he met with a bipartisan group of congressional leaders to reach an agreement. The meeting was supposed to last an hour, but broke up after about half an hour. The Iraq War spending bill went back to Congress for a procedural vote to try to override the president's veto. The Democrats didn't have the two-thirds majority necessary for the override. The House vote was 222 to 203. Around 4,000 American troops are entering Baghdad this week as part of the U.S. troop surge. They are part of the fourth of five brigades brought in to control the sectarian violence in the Iraqi capital. Across Iraq today, at least 85 people were killed in violence. Three U.S. soldiers were killed in Baghdad. Tomorrow, a regional conference will be held in Egypt to discuss the security situation in Iraq. There are more high-level calls for Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert to resign after Monday's release of a highly critical review of how he handled the war against Hezbollah last summer. Israel's foreign minister is the latest top official to ask the prime minister to leave office. She told him in a private meeting it was, quote, the right thing to do. Turkey's prime minister asked parliament today to approve an earlier date for national elections. He asked for June 24th. The elections had been scheduled for November 4th. On the 10th anniversary of his election as Prime Minister, Britain's Tony Blair today announced he will be stepping down within a few weeks. French voters go to the polls Sunday in the runoff presidential election between Gaullist candidate Nicolas Sarkozy and socialist candidate Ségolène Royal. The two candidates took part in their first and only televised debate today. Tomorrow, the Republican candidates for the 2008 presidential election will meet at the Reagan Library in Southern California for their first presidential